Well, Joe, as we sit here,
do you think you have enough gain on that?
Yeah.
Stupid little bit.
As we sit here in weird manner, enjoying the view of the beautiful city of Los Angeles through the smog,
which of course you can't see enough of.
No smog today.
Fog.
Mr. Ed Coor, say howdy do, folks.
How do you do?
And Mr. Joseph A. Rushton Jr.
Joseph Augustine Rushton.
Augustine, is that it? I wondered about that.
What's your...
I refuse to answer. Dunbar. If I ever hear anybody using that term, I...
Now I have something on
you. Yes, I'm afraid you have. Augustine, I say that's quite...
Well, actually, according to my old man, that was his middle name. I being named after him, you see. Yes. His father went to a parochial school in England called St. Augustine's. And so in England, apparently they pronounced that name Augustine instead of Augustine, although it's spelled exactly the same. So he was so fond of his alma mater that he named Pop after his school. And I managed to get it. But when I had my own little boy, I decided none of that stuff, so I gave him a different middle name, which happens to be Alden, so he's still Joseph A. Rushton, but has no three or nothing on that jazz on the end of it.
Well, I think I...
Where did the Alden come from? What is your wife's first name?
Well, it doesn't happen to have anything to do with the courtship of you-know-who.
That's right, by golly. Priscilla, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, but it's one of her mother's relates or something. It was very fine of her. Mm-hmm. Well, she picked it out.
You know, you'll hear these Hollywood birds you have out the window here, too.
You think they'll...
Tripping their way.
You must have a tremendous amount of decibels cranked up on that infernal machine up there.
Not especially, but you can't see that.
I see the potentiometer or whatever
that
is.
That was the line influence. You see the lights flicker then?
Oh, yeah.
You'll hear the clock.
Oh, yeah.
You may hear that motor. I don't know.
Might be.
You'll hear possibly. Too,
but the birds, most surely.
Oh, yeah, you get all that ultrasonic routine on that. That's the silliest looking little microphone to do as well as it does. Now, what was that other one you were using last year?
75-cent job, it looks like. Well, it's made by the same company, Joe. In fact, the same demodulator, the unit. The same one, exactly, the same box. But this one here has a smaller diaphragm, presents a smaller pattern in the field, which means a better high-frequency response. And the definition in the mid-range is better than the old one was.
How about the bottom? Would the smaller diaphragm affect that?
No, one cycle per week, that thing.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, sure, it goes down to nothing.
Well, who makes it? Beautiful.
Stevens, here in Culver City.
Oh, I see. Well, what was that mic you were using last year?
Stevens. Different head, that was the only thing.
Right. Preceding model.
Well, not exactly. Now, there's a question I can't pin down. I can't get them to answer satisfactorily. Why do they make these two models?
Are they still making them currently?
Yes, they are. Oh. That's the odd part of it. I sold mine at a bargain. Yeah. I had two of them. And
sold that for somebody for $1,800.
No.
It was real cheap.
When I tested this one here, the others went out the window like a shot. I just didn't want to...
Well, this is sturdier than the other model, too, isn't it?
Sturdier? I believe you're right. I believe it could be called sturdier.
Maybe we ought to put it this way. It's not as delicate. Though.
Yeah, that's right.
They're both sensitive.
Yeah, they're both sensitive, and you can't... I love these guys that come into the room and seeing that mic standing, some which I haven't. No, here's what they do. The first thing, they take their fingernail and tap, tap on the guard of the diaphragm. Yeah. I feel like killing somebody.
Have you ever had anybody come up and go, on the diaphragm?
No, I haven't had them do that. That's why I use that little rubber gimmick.
Yeah.
I told you about that time.
The moisture is wonderful on this.
Yeah. That my wife took the microphone out of the case of the recording session and started walking across the room with it and sat it up on the stand with that rubber tube on the top of it.
Yeah.
And I was listening, trying to figure out what kind of a noise that was. And holy smokers, it just shows how sensitive those things are to field patterns.
That is even through the rubber cap.
Oh, my. Why, I'll put it on. We'll just listen to how it sounds.
Back.
Yeah, this is the way it sounds. Now, if you will talk a bit. That looks very inoffensive, doesn't it?
Well, it's open on the top, though.
Sure,
you
sure.
know, you would naturally get a certain amount of response out of it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well,
sure. Well, I imagine with that rubber cap on there, that the resulting sound, when you listen to the playback of the thing, would sound just about like my voice, or your voice, rather, would sound just about like old fat Charlie Connors, wouldn't you think?
Well, not that bad. Not that bad.
That'd be pretty, I'd have to be pretty rough, I guess.
More like his counterpart, Fats Waller.
Yes. But speaking of Charlie, I thought of a real nasty crack I heard. Somebody called him something. Who asked about Connors?
Was it Red?
Red, I guess. What does he call him?
I don't know. Can't remember.
He called him some very good name, though. An appropriate name. It was a hell of a nasty name.
Well, Charlie is a rather appropriate cat.
Yeah, I think so, too. Let's talk about something pleasant. What do you say?
Yeah, let's get off this.
All right. Let's take this off.
Take the rubber tin off.
Now, who can I play this for now?
You may play it for Bubbles.
You cut up like this, and I got to play this for ladies and gentlemen.
Well, there's one thing. One thing I think you want to know, Ewing, as long as there's another Ed in the house.
You'll forgive the expression.
is about the two bass saxophones that Joe has. And I think that it would be well if he would just describe a little of how he got onto a bass saxophone in the first place.
I think so, too.
Originally playing alto, wasn't it, Joe?
Well, no, not originally, but when I started messing around with horns and things, I guess the drums were the first thing I got onto, and then clarinet. But of course, like the boob that I am, I didn't take advantage of the opportunities that I had to study. As a result, not lesson one, except for a few on drums to learn how to hold the stakes and about three of the first basic rudiments, but not on the clarinet or the wind instruments, a fact which I regret today, as a matter of fact, because I used the wrong fingering and I never did learn to read terribly well. Oh, I can get by, but it has to be in the bass clef. So all during the 20s, I started the first saxophone was soprano, actually, Curve B flat. And then I ran the gamut of the rest of them, alto and tenor and baritone. But of course, during that time, I was privileged to cast an ear at the California Ramblers at the Ramblers Inn.
And oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
A. Rolini was the guy that made me sick to my stomach. I think that that Hugh Panassier, or one of those, Charles Delaunay, one of those guys that wrote that hot jazz thing,
you know, Frank,
his description of Adrian's sound, I think, is about as adequate as any I've heard. He said he describes it as a beautiful, noble tone, which it has a certain element of.
Yeah, Adrian did get a wonderful tone.
That sound was just too much.
Well, do you know where Adrian is now?
Well, he's usually in New York down in his fishing lodge in Key Largo, Florida.
Yeah, that's a carriage right here.
Oh, have you? Have you seen him?
Yeah, I saw him a couple of years ago.
Well, I saw him in 50. That's the last time I saw him in Chicago. He's playing the Blue Note.
That's about when I
Joe, saw. What's that fellow's name that now lives in Pittsburgh, I
believe? Oh, Spence Clark.
Do you know Spence Clark?
Oh, he's a dear friend of mine.
Well, for gosh sake, I've got a six-part
certainly,
record.
So have I.
I wonder if he sent that to you.
No, Squirrel Ashcraft himself brought it out and gave it to me.
He did. Well, I think we made that at my house.
John Steiner has.
Yeah, John made it.
Yeah.
We used John's machine and mine.
Well, he's done another one since then.
Yeah, he did it at my house. Yeah.
No, but the second one, he did it at Ashcraft's.
Did he?
Or rather, at Jack Howell's place, which used to be Ashcraft's house in Evanston.
He did.
He did one last summer. They have a big summer festival. Bix meaning Beetle Batch, and they call it the Sons of Bix, which is very clever. And these guys who used to be professional, most of them not actually musicians, outside of Spence and Howard Kennedy.
Well, Spence is not playing professionally.
No, once in a while a gig here and a gig there. But there's a guy that came possibly closer to Adrian than anyone I know. And I know several guys that have attempted to become involved with the bass sax. And Spence has a wonderful harmonic intuitiveness, you might say. Uh-huh. And he knows his chords. He has a pretty good grounding in theory. He can play a little bit of everything. He plays a little bit of piano, guitar, trumpet, clarinet, all the saxophones. And he naturally was taken with Adrian also. And he was a neighbor of his, as a matter of fact, and was usually first call. If Adrian was not available for a date, Spence would do it. Uh-huh. In fact, they both worked together in the Burt Lounge Band about 1934, 33. Adrian was playing fourth sax in the saxophone section, and Spence was playing bass. Uh-huh. I mean, bass parts, you know. Yeah. I heard that band on the air, and I thought that Spence was with Waring, because he had been. Mm-hmm. And I thought that Adrian was with Lopez, mm-hmm. which he also had been. So I wrote a letter to Bert Lau, and I explained to him the situation that I just told you, and he wrote me back a very nice letter and said, you'd be quite surprised to know that both Adrian and Clark are in the band, and told me what they were doing, which is rather unusual.
Well, then Adrian, that is listening to Adrian, was that what influenced you in getting trying to play bass saxophone?
I should say it did. A lot of us that had baritones used to try to copy some of his stuff off the records, and of course it was impossible because of the difference in pitch.
Well, you use a baritone mouthpiece on your instrument. Well, did Adrian use a baritone?
Yeah. The only difference actually is the width of the lay. Yeah. The chamber inside is the same. It's those old mouthpieces have a large chamber. The new ones today you can't use because the throat's too small. Mm-hmm. But those old rubber baritones and some of the metal links, in fact I'm using a link now as a matter of fact, they have a big enough chamber so that it doesn't louse up the scale. But there's an awful lot of other things to go into, such as the neck and the things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular difference in the two instruments you have?
No, they're essentially the same. Yes, they're both cons, and they're both in the same series, 100,000.
Well, you had another con here not too long ago.
Yeah, that was a gold job that I got when I was a good one.
Well, that one.
That's the same.
The finger buttons were actually at
they were placed
different locations. Than
well,
on
mainly the top D and E flat. They were too high up on the horn. You had to reach for them.
Uh-huh.
But that gold horn head was the same. Is the same series as Spence Clark's horn.
Has he got one of those?
He's got a 77,000, yeah. Which I rather suspect might have been an old horn Adrian's. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It was a real good saxophone, except that if I had to put one in the shop, I don't like to have to get used to the other one, you see.
Yeah, you had to change your feel all the time.
Well, you lose your facility up there.
Well, you know, I just wonder, wouldn't be a good idea to, is there anything about your instrument that you could demonstrate, Joe, that would sound good?
I don't. I'd rather
you're this kind.
Oh, you mean here?
Yeah.
Oh God.
No, I don't mean play anything. I don't mean that. I mean just a couple of honks.
Well, I think you got quite enough of that yesterday.
Limehouse
type blues. Fap, sound like Tom Brown.
Oh, I know what you can do. You can dig back in your memory and come up with that old arrangement that you used to do down in Southgate with Horace.
Oh, you mean Asleep in the Stuff?
Yes.
Well, that was a strange routine.
You were the saddest looking man I think I ever saw when he called that.
Well, poor Buzz Adlam, a wonderful musician, had never written anything for solo bass sax before. And he was not familiar at that time with some of the fingering problems that I myself am confronted with due to certain things. And he wrote about two-thirds of the thing in the key of A. And I was supposed to hot it up a bit, fills and things of that kind, and it didn't lie very good, let's put it that way. To say nothing of the fact that it was just didn't have it for me, but you can't imagine Horace ever thinking of any other tune to feature the bass sax on but that. I mean, that fingers.
Oh, yeah.
I have nothing against Horace. He and I got along pretty well. But
Sleep in the Deep, you mean?
Sleep in the Deep.
Yeah. Gee whiz, Joe, that would be wonderful if you could play.
Well, I've got I couldn't remember how it went. I've got an air check of it, but it's on glass and it's cracked.
Oh.
And I'm afraid to do it, for I'll tear my needle off.
Yeah. Well, did that go down to your low A flat?
No, he took me down. I ended on A concert. Low
half
B.
Tone up,
huh? Yeah, low B on the horn. When he could have ended with A flat.
Yeah.
You're running out of tape there, Liz.
Three sharps instead of, or in four flats instead of three sharps, you'd have been all right.
Sure.